from deep inside your radio.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I have trademarked, only in my imagination, of course, the word Usainity to describe fanship for Usain Bolt. I'd be amazed if he hasn't trademarked it already, because he is so darn proud. He's the best athlete who's ever lived. So let's, you know what I say? Let's take him at his word and knock off any further Olympics. Usain, you got it, babe. It's retired. Go have a happy rest of your life. It's not going to be threatened. Paul Ryan has been anointed. Would that be the right word? Or just anointed as Mitt Romney's putative, that would be the word, vice presidential candidate. That would seem to sum up the actual news on this weekend, which would leave only news of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole Jr. Yeah, it's probably going to be the last time for a while. So let's make it good, shall we? London's 2012 Olympic organizers are investigating how a bucket of unofficial condoms found its way into the athletes' village without official consent. The Australian BMX cyclist Carolyn Buchanan tweeted a photograph of the bucket, which featured a sign reading "Kangaroo Condoms for the Gland Down Under" and a picture of a boxing kangaroo. Barcelona started the trend of supplying free condoms to athletes when the Spanish city held the Olympics in 1992, with the International Olympics Committee endorsing the move. Jacques Rogge? Really? The best Olympics ever, babe. He's going to say it. You know that. The London Olympic organizers provided 150,000 free condoms for the 10,800 athletes at the Games, supplied by Durex, which paid for the endorsement rights, the official condom union. Of course you know that. A LOCOG spokeswoman said they were trying to find out who distributed the kangaroo condoms. The container is shown to hold condoms from Durex's rivals, Ansell Limited, an Australian company, and Passante, a private British firm. She said athletes and officials were allowed to bring products into the village for their personal use. We will look into this and ask that they are not handed out to other athletes because Durex are our supplier, said the spokesperson. Lawrence Boone, the managing director of Passante, said his company had no involvement with the distribution of condoms in the athletes' village, and he suspected it was a prank by the Australian team. A spokeswoman for Ansell had said her company knew nothing about the issue, and it could well be a prank. A Durex spokeswoman, that's right, said the company was proud to be supplying free condoms for the Olympic Games, declining to elaborate further. And a decision to close Africa Village because of unpaid bills has nothing to do with the Association of National Olympic Committees of Africa, ANOCA, the governing body of the African Olympic Committees, claimed this week and threatened to take legal action against the French company responsible for managing Olympic Village. The village was hosting regular music concerts, and African medalists were visiting to share their triumphs with fans. But it closed Wednesday of this week when the company in charge of security withdrew its support because it was among several suppliers owed a total of $620,000. ANOCA claimed it was because Pixcom, the French company responsible for its management, had failed to pay its bills on time. The closure, which is consequent on a dispute between a French enterprise and some English companies, has impacted our continent most adversely, especially since our only desire when we initiated this project was to exhibit Africa's rich cultural diversity to the English public and visitors from other countries, said ANOCA. We think the closure was an arbitrary action taken without even notifying ANOCA and those who had set up stands or producing any official document issued by an English court. Officers from the Metropolitan Police have been guarding the front of the village since the closure. Pixcom's chief executive admitted there were some outstanding debts, but it claimed the company's awaiting payment had overreacted. Both Anoka and Pixcom are now threatening legal action against different parties. The Olympics, ladies and gentlemen, it's a movement, and we all need one every day. This is a very special edition of Le Show, and now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for me to read the trades for you. This is from American Banker. You know who reads this. New questions about banks' force-placed insurance deals. This is complicated. I'm going to read it for you. It has to do with the new F-bomb. Another wrinkle. It's so wrinkled it needs maybe jet spraying. The first time Luis Juarez heard of force-placed insurance was when he received a $25,000 bill for it in the mail. A Florida doctor and homeowner, Juarez had been dropped by his previous insurer over a roofing issue. Though that lapse violated his obligation under the mortgage to retain insurance coverage on the property, he was current on his loan payments and heard nothing from his servicer, Wells Fargo, for more than a year. Then on May 10th, 2 years ago, Juarez got a note from QBE Specialty Insurance, a partner of Wells Fargo. It said QBE was retroactively charging him $25,000 for a policy that had expired 2 months earlier. Neither the price tag, nearly quadruple his original policy's rate, nor the expired status of the QBE policy was a mistake. The use of carriers like QBE adds another public wrinkle to the controversy over banks' imposition of homeowners' coverage. Because the carriers are unregulated in states such as Florida, Wells Fargo, SunTrust Banks, and others are buying what is called surplus line insurance, neither guaranteed by state premium caps. Neither governed by state premium caps nor guaranteed by state funds. That leaves the insurer free to charge whatever rates it pleases and to share some of the proceeds with the banks. Force-placed insurance is already under fire from a coalition of state attorneys general because it burdens troubled homeowners with expensive premiums, provides inferior coverage, and often dumps the cost on mortgage investors at the time of foreclosure if borrowers fail to pay the premiums. In the process, banks reap lucrative commissions from the insurers. Though there is no evidence that the banks sought surplus line coverage because of its potential to carry higher prices, borrower advocates say the company's use of unregulated carriers exposes homeowners and mortgage investors to higher costs and greater risks. Force-placed insurance is lucrative for mortgage servicers. An American Banker story published last year found that banks often collect sizable force-placed commissions from insurers, even when servicers do not perform significant work in the production of the policy. Mortgage bond analysts have flagged this relationship as a potential conflict of interest. Out of concern that banks were unfairly profiting from struggling homeowners, state attorneys general are now seeking to restrict the practice. It's not possible to evaluate how QBE's state rates stack up against other insurers in Florida because its surplus line status means it does not have to disclose such data. Given that servicers regularly receive a percentage commission on the policies, these are mortgage servicers, there's little financial incentive for banks to press for low prices or show restraint when issuing insurance policies. In a while. In some instances, banks partnering with QBE have forced borrowers to pay for insurance in excess of their property's value. SunTrust declined to discuss its relationship with QBE or the cost of its insurance. Others in the industry cautioned against jumping to the conclusion that all high prices were abusive. All right. We'll just sit right here. We won't jump. One possible reason why agents buying QBE insurance might not be checking with their competitors for lower rates is because they appear to work for QBE. Several notices of coverage viewed by American Banker all listed an employee for Sterling National Insurance Agency, a QBE subsidiary, as both the basic producing agent and the surplus line agent for the coverage. The agent in question declined to speak with American Banker. The new F-bomb, ladies and gentlemen, is exploding all around us. A conclusion I reach when I read the trades for you, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Hello, welcome to the show.
It's like trying to stand up. You've been hit by a gust of wind. I've spent so many years just hanging around. Now it's time to go back to my hometown. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. I don't need a reason. Feels like holiday season, and I'm on my way back to Blighty again. Again. Well, I've got a really bad feeling about who's. It's too hard to sort out. It's too hard to discuss. Well, I've spent so many years just hanging around. Now it's a time to go back to my hometown. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. Like holiday season, and I'm on my way back to Blighty again. Again. What I wouldn't give for a little bit of filthy weather. Sometimes what I wouldn't give for a late ride in a black cab or a double. Cause I got a really bad feeling about who's trying to stand up, and you've been hit by a gust of wind. Well, so many things I don't really understand. It's like trying to be a woman. It's like trying to be a good man. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way.
This is Le Show, and for years, some time ago, I did a series of programs featuring piano players, sometimes even singers from New Orleans. We're now in a different place, in a different time, and the tradition is being renewed. In the studio with me today for a chat and some music is a gentleman I became acquainted with the old-fashioned way, little 3x5 cards on telephone poles with his home number. No, through his records, Charlie Wood. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And people on the, who listen to this program have heard your work. I don't even know who was it that turned me on to you, but was it your first record, Southbound?
I reckon it was, I think it was at Southbound that you first played, and you played a bunch of them. I think it was Jim Spake. My buddy, tenor player, sax player Jim Speck from Memphis, Tennessee.
Well, you owe him big time, baby.
I do, actually. in more ways than one, but yeah. Particularly for this. I don't know, I've been lucky. People seem to feel very strongly about me one way or another. people who
now,
people
I know
who
that
like
feeling.
Have been great.
Yeah. So you were born and bred in Memphis?
Yeah. I was born and raised. I lived, as you know, for a few years in New Orleans. And then
and something rubbed off.
Absolutely. Yeah. I rubbed around in as much as I could get hold of in New Orleans and hoped that as much of it would stick to me as possible. But it's a piano town, isn't it? It's fantastic. Tradition there, and Memphis also. Memphis and New Orleans have in common that they are places where different styles of music have kind of intersected and cross-pollinated quite a lot. And there's actually a lot of cross-pollination between Memphis and New Orleans.
You blame the river?
Yeah, I suppose I do. Yeah. I know that the Musicians Union, I think. The U.S. one started in Memphis for people working on the riverboats. That was the first union for professional musicians in the United States. Unless, of course, I'm wrong. But I think that's true.
And it was also the last one.
Yeah.
Judging by current developments.
It's lost a considerable amount of impetus.
Since James C. Petrillo was running it. So Memphis, New Orleans, then back to Memphis, and you started doing these records pretty much on your own steam, right?
Well, I did Southbound on my own steam with lots of help from the great musicians who were on it, and one particular arranger, Tom Clary, and the guitarist, Steve Winger, was fantastic too, and he ran the studio where it was recorded to 8-track.
Wow.
Which is why it sounds so good. I don't mean that the playing is wonderful. I'm just saying that sonically. Although, you know, the playing's all right, too.
Playing's great. And the arranging is great. And the singing and the writing. And
Tom
the
did some... thank you. Tom Clary did some fantastic arrangements for that record. The Man on the Money stands out in my memory as one that people still ask about.
Yeah.
Sometimes I pretend to have arranged it. I'm coming clean. But then it was picked up about a year after... We finished it by Ben Sidran on his Go Jazz label, and he's another person who's been very kind to me and very supportive, sort of championing my stuff. I did a couple of records on his label and met a lot of great people there.
And were those records done in Memphis as well?
The next one, yeah. Well, let's see, I guess there were only two that were released on Go Jazz, and then Ben kind of shifted gears and now has... Nardis Records.
Which is Sidran spelled backwards, right?
It certainly is, yeah.
I did. I went right through that.
Yeah, he made Miles Davis aware of that fact, I think. I think I remember him telling me. He interviewed, you know, Sidran has interviewed a lot of jazz musicians, and he told Miles that he asked Miles if he had written the song Nardis because it was Sidran backwards. I think Miles said, maybe.
Yeah, in your dreams, baby. So how is Memphis as a town to be a working musician these days?
Man, it's the best of towns, it's the worst of towns. It's these days, I'm probably not the one to ask. I don't think it's changed that much. People in professional music there were concerned that it might be changing for the worse because there is a lot of work there. There are a lot of gigs. There's a lot of live music being performed. Not all of it is listening, you know, venues, music venues. But people definitely, I mean, a lot of the tourism in Memphis is based around music, historical and current, and a lot of different styles. People come there for Elvis Presley, obviously, and certainly for Stax and all of the music that came out of that, Sam and Dave and Otis Redding and all that. But they also come for country music. There's a massive... there's a huge rap thing in Memphis that's been extremely successful, and there've been motion picture soundtracks and Grammys won and that sort of thing in that genre, straight out of Memphis. So it's hard to pin down stylistically, but it's a place where one can earn a living playing music, which is not something you can say of most places. Typically, you have to have a teaching gig, or you have to do something else, or your partner has to work and finance your you know, your musical hobby. But in Memphis, you can do it professionally, and you can play music for a living because there's enough work in Memphis and the surrounding areas. So.
Okay, so before we pick up your story, give us a little sense of for people who haven't connected you to what they've heard on the show of what it is you sound like and what it is you do.
Man. Verbally describe what I sound like?
No.
Oh, okay. Thank heaven.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, a demonstration.
It's Mantovani meets Stockhausen.
Paint a word picture without words and without pictures.
Should I play a number?
Yeah.
Man.
Since you're sitting at a piano.
I am sitting at a really nice piano. I have no one to blame but myself if this doesn't sound good.
Or the tuner.
Shall I play? I can't even blame him. It's freshly tuned this morning. You want a bouncy number?
A bouncy C.
How about that the New Orleans song? Since we're talking about New Orleans.
Oh, great! Great! This is a song that Charlie wrote that is featured with a vocal by Irma Thomas as the end title of a film called The Big Uneasy. But here it is by Charlie himself.
It's always been, it's going to be again. We're never gonna stop the partying, we're never gonna stop New Orleans. Got people in New Orleans from most every place. It's a funky microcosm of the human race. I really like it like that. So tell me where y'all at. Never stop the party, man. Never gonna stop New Orleans. Ask his crooked little friend, are your pockets deep enough to hold this money I send? They let New Orleans down. They let some good folks drown. Remember that the next election calls Washington forgotten New Orleans. People in the quarter might have caught a little break. The people in the night ward got more than they could take. They had to fight to survive. Trina and Rita left them barely alive. You're never gonna stop the weather, but they're never gonna stop New Orleans. Mississippi from New Orleans, L.A., Rubberneck to St. Domino, long hair, Marsalis, Booker, Connick, Jelly Rolls from there. You're never gonna stop the music, and never gonna stop New Orleans. Never gonna close the kitchen, and never gonna stop New Orleans. never gonna stop the partying, never gonna stop New Orleans.
You mentioned a few musicians in that little list at the end. Did you ever see Fess, Professor Longhair, or James Booker live?
I didn't see either one. They were both gone by the time I got down there, unfortunately. Well, now, let's see. Is that true? I may tell a lie on that. I got down there in 85 and was down there until 88, I think.
You were going to Tulane, right?
Yeah. I was informally pursuing a...
pursuing an education, which
degree,
which was escaping you as you as you pursued it.
What is the? I never allowed my schooling to interfere with my education. Mark Twain.
So, whom would you number among your influences musically? I hear Mose Allison, the great Mississippi blues man, in you.
Thank you very much for hearing him in me. I certainly hope so. He's a hero of mine. I'm crazy about Mose Allison as a writer and as a player, so I hope that's true, and I've certainly heard him many a time live. As a developing musician, well, I hope I still am a developing musician, but as a much younger developing musician, I tried really hard to absorb all I could of Mose Allison and also of Ray Charles, but I also listened to a lot of loads of Chet Baker. I listened to loads of Billie Holiday, and I also listen to some pop people that I like very much, especially as songwriters, like, James Taylor, I'm crazy about, and Paul Simon, and also Elvis Costello, Peter Gabriel. I listen to all the Stax people, and I started out studying classical music, so I don't know, it's just kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah, you do a wonderful version of Paul Simon's American Tune.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I got that you were into him. Study classical music, eh? How long?
Long as they would have me. I think I did get fired by my last classical instructor. I think I got fired by my last two. I went back and tried to do it some more and got canned.
Was this an attitude issue?
No, not at all. I think I was very, very pleasant and humble and affable guy. I just wouldn't practice.
That was my problem.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
It's terrible. I played all the time, but not what I was supposed to be playing.
Yeah. My problem was that I was an ear player, and they kept trying to force me to read, and I just was like...
Oh, this is exactly my problem. I used to sit and try to get the teacher to play it, and then once she played it, I was a lot further on. I mean, I waited until really late to sort of apply myself to it. I'm still not a great reader. I'm okay. I mean, I have to write big band scores and parts for lots of musicians and stuff, so obviously I can read music now, but I really, I think my ear, and you're probably the same way, my ear really held up my reading because I preferred to learn that way.
My teacher forbade my parents to buy records of the concertos I was learning because she knew that I'd just learn them off the records, and so I had no idea what I was playing. You know, I knew bar by bar what I was doing, but I never had a sense of the whole piece until we'd play it at a recital. Which is like a horrible way to play music. You know what?
But deeply ingrained. I mean, once you know it, you really, really know it.
I guess.
You don't need the music.
Yeah. So, from Memphis, how did you get over here? We're broadcasting from London right now. It's a long way from Memphis.
It is indeed. And it's a great place to be. And it's an interesting summer, isn't it? The Olympics going on.
You've forgotten about the Queen's Jubilee that quickly.
There was that.
Yeah.
Mitt Romney was in town.
Yeah, that's right.
It's been nonstop.
Nonstop incitement.
Excitement. the Jubilee was amazing. I didn't witness most of that secondhand, but I did thankfully participate in the Olympics a little bit. Not as an athlete, as you might imagine.
Not yet.
Not yet. No. Although they are considering me for the men's synchronized slouch.
Dreams die hard. So what got you from Memphis to London?
Memphis is a very musical city, and there are a lot of gigs to play there, and there are a lot of musicians I admire very much, but there isn't a real industry presence in Memphis. So the sessions are they're more frequent than they have been in the past 20 years, but they're few and far between. and there's not an enormous amount of, you know, chance of you being sort of involved in projects that you didn't set out to involve yourself in. Things aren't going to just coalesce around you with like-minded people noticing you and you hearing them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that can happen here. There's so many musicians here, and there's so much going on in terms of acts that book out of here and recording that's being done, and God knows how many symphony orchestras there are in London. But I mean, I think it's upwards of 20.
Yeah.
It's not two or three.
Yeah.
I mean, there are loads and loads of big bands, and there are loads and loads of small ensembles doing various things, and incredible singers, and it's a city of musicians.
Yeah.
I think it has been for hundreds of years, and I wanted to be involved in that. I think, you know, you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. So I'll always be here as a foreign visitor, but I feel very much at home here, and I love it here. I hope I get to stay.
I love it here too. But the cliche version of that journey for American musicians would be to New York. You deliberately chose not to go to New York.
I had a lot of friends in London. I love New York, and I spent time in New York and just thoroughly enjoyed it. And there's certainly a lot of wonderful players and a lot going on in New York as well. But I had been coming to Europe in general and London more frequently than other places. Well, I played a lot in Spain and Italy over the last sort of 10 years, but I've been coming to London quite a bit, just on sort of short trips, 1 week, 2 week. Someone would set up a run of work at Pizza Express, Dean Street, and then I would do something in the north, and then I would go home. But I met a lot of great players who became friends. And I also have some friends who aren't professional musicians, believe it or not.
That is so tolerant of you. Now, in that context, one of the people that you did not mention as an influence, but you've come to know here, is I hear him in your singing and your style as well, is Georgie Fang.
Oh, man. I was hoping you were going to say that.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. But, Georgie's another hero of mine. He's great. And he's really cool. I don't know anybody. Well, he's really cool, full stop. But he's cool in that he does not allow himself to be pinned down stylistically. But he does that without changing what he does. I mean, you'd have to sort of look at somebody like, I don't know, Ray Charles to say that same thing, that he can show up and be identifiably himself and not alter what he does, and fit into so many different genres, and be really convincing and satisfying to hear in a wide variety of things. He's got just a fantastic voice, he's a fantastic player, obviously, as well. But he's been very supportive of my work too, and he's somebody I admire very much.
So let's hear one of your own compositions now.
That I could do. I wrote a couple of years ago this incredibly depressing song that I just love. I guess this would be maybe the first recording of it. I've performed it live.
Oh, this is not the one you were talking about, that I thought you were talking about. This is not.
If I say my incredibly depressing song, I do need to be more specific.
Yeah, because you've written more than one. This is not You Don't Really Want to Know, which David Torkanowski has warned the grooves out on
really?
His radio show on WWOZ.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, I've got to rehash the lyrics of that before I can sing them convincingly, because I've got no notes, ladies and gentlemen. There's absolutely nothing.
No, you were playing without a net and without a note.
Man.
So what's this one called?
This is a song called Don't Think. But, the views expressed here are solely my own. Don't think when she sits too close and stays there, when her eyes meet yours and linger, when she makes a point of touching your hand as she laughs and throws her hair back, that all of that means anything. That's just the way she does. Don't think
when he tells you you've surprised him, and you're not like all the others, and you're different and you're special, and he's never felt such strong connections that all of that means anything. That's just the way he does. Rats in their mazes, scrambling for the cheese. Kids in the kitchen, learning to say please. Gray-haired congregations, knobbing up their knees. Hard not to catch that survival disease. Don't think when they handshake and they backslap, and they how's it going, buddy? And they tell you they'd be happy to see you get everything you want to. But all of that means anything, that's just the way they do. Class-cutting college kids mining for fool's gold. Hot young commodity is waiting to get sold. Schmucks in their cubicles doing what they're told, hoping to get older, hoping to get old. Don't think when it's seeping through the sandbags, when it's ripping up the rule books, when it's burning down the markets and filling up paradise with poison, that you could have done anything. That's just the way it does. That's just the way it does.
Darkness. Darkness, baby. Never heard the word schmucks sung before.
I so badly wanted to write a song with the word schmuck in it, avoiding the obvious rhymes.
Yeah.
So I feel pleased, if for no other reason than having done that.
Have you spent any time listening to Dave Frischberg?
I love Dave Frischberg.
Yeah, I'm hearing...
I did as so many people do, a tuba record. And
well, join the club.
That's kind of, you know, play to the gallery. But I did with my buddy Jim Shearer, who's the director of the program out at New Mexico. I did him on tuba, and me on various keyboards and singing, obviously, and lots of other great players. And we did a version of Can't Take You Nowhere.
Mm.
And we got a really nice letter from Dave Frischberg saying, you know, cut it out. No, saying that he liked it.
Liked the tuba.
Which is very funny. And liked the tuba. Well, what's not to like?
Yeah.
Jim's a great player.
Just because I'm sometimes remembering what I said wrong, the first song was your writing as well. That wasn't the first of these compositions.
Right. So yes. It's not to make a distinction, yeah.
That's right. So London, and then your life changed a bit more than you might have expected, right?
It certainly did. There's a wonderful jazz singer and songwriter herself from London called Jackie Dankworth. And she had recorded a song that I wrote called Lucky Charm in the mid-noughties, which I enjoy saying, on her record As the Sun Shines Down. And a mutual friend of ours, a drummer called Chris Wells, made me aware that she had done that. And we sort of met each other via email and talked a bit. And then she came to a gig I was doing in London, and
not the Chinese restaurant gig.
No, thankfully, no. Otherwise,
this would never have happened.
Never have happened, right? No, it was under slightly more glamorous circumstances, fewer fish. But she was really lovely and nice, and sort of very interested in my music and apparently me, which is just really lucky and very, very mutual. So we wound up getting married a couple of years ago.
You impetuous kids.
What's that?
You impetuous kids.
Well, I figured.
You hot-blooded Southerners.
I didn't let that one get away. She's a fantastic person and an amazing musician, as probably a lot of your listeners know quite well.
And if I'm reading the liner notes right, she produced your last record,
She
last
did
night?
Indeed.
Yeah.
And sang on a track, but produced the whole thing. It was amazing. It was very, very, very good at saying, in the nicest and the most productive way, the two things that you have to say is, you know, what if you did this, and what if you maybe didn't so much do that, and that's just the thing that must be said, you know, to me anyway.
Oh.
So I think she did a fantastic job.
So you do work together with Jackie?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, she has a flourishing music career.
Yeah.
So I tend to I've been her MD for a little while now, and I play piano with her quite a bit. We've actually got some shows coming up later this month.
In the United Kingdom?
Yeah. In I just realized I don't know the name of the festival. We're playing a festival on the 25th of August in North London, sort of Highgate area.
The Posh Festival.
It is the Poshington Fest.
Posh Fest.
No, they excluded us from that one, but we're playing the other one. We're playing the opening. We're playing the Fringe Posh Fest. I don't know the name of the festival or the venue or what time it is.
All right, well, we'll be there.
Cost, but other than that, yeah.
We're there.
It's August 25th, and it's organized by a fantastic tenor player called Brandon Allen. Saxophonist, tenor and other. And it features some of London's finest.
Now, let me ask you a question. There was a time when, if you said London and jazz in the same breath, musically knowledgeable Americans would get a look of some disdain on their faces. Is that... that's?
Well, I mean, I think it's not for me to say, but that is well and truly over that perception. God, last month, Jackie and I went to a concert that her niece Emily Dankworth was involved in. It was a choral concert, the Abyssinian Mass, that went Marcellus and the Lincoln Center big band and lots of other great singers were doing. It was an amazing concert, an amazing composition. I think they were spending 2 weeks over here, and I know that if you talk to people like Wenton and people in his band, the esteem in which they hold the players in London is equal to anywhere in the world, certainly equal to New York and to other places where, I mean, there is, you know, jazz has obviously an historical provenance. It is African music, and it developed in the United States. That being said, you know, saying that someone from London can't play jazz as well as someone from New York is like saying that someone from New York can't play classical music as well as someone from Vienna. I mean, you could argue it either way, but you'd better hear the people in New York before you go too far on that. Because everybody's listening to the same records now, and it's to do with intention and work. It's nothing in the water or anything. People have to go and do it. But, I mean, the players here, I think they've always been excellent musically. They've always been excellent readers and excellent technicians. And to play with a lot of depth and originality and brilliant composers from here and so on. But there, I would say probably in the last 20 and 30 years, the barrier that's been removed is the feel barrier that guys here, you know, just swing every bit as well if they're playing swing, and they play R&B stuff every bit as well, and they're brilliant improvisers, and they, you know, a lot of them are just, everybody's played with everybody now.
Yeah.
Everybody travels, and I think that's, it's just over. If you are an American jazz musician and you're listening to this and you think that you can come to London and wow everybody with your amazing American feel, look out, is all I'm saying, because there's probably a 17-year-old guy over here who will scare you to death.
Maybe it has something to do with the fact that there's actually good food in London now.
That's another thing that's kind of...
it really has changed.
I think it's all thanks to us. I think thanks to the presence of an adequate number of Americans in London. The food and music
Well, if that's so, then the only barrier we have yet to crash is to get someplace where you can, indoors where you can play basketball.
That would be fantastic.
That would be fantastic. That would be nice. Now, mentioning the record that your wife produced for you or with you, that's a record of what we have been trained to call standards, although yeah, in America. And the title song is something I asked you to play before the show. So you've worked it up.
I brushed up on it.
Brushed up your lush life.
It's a hard song, I have to say, and it's a great jazz song to pick because it's written by Billy Strayhorn, and he is maybe first and foremost a songwriter, and then after that a jazz composer. But it's a great example of the song in what I would still identify as a contemporary jazz setting. I wish there were more like that, but I'll try to do justice to this. I used to visit all the very gay places, those come what may places, where one relaxes on the axis of the wheel of life, to get the feel of life from jazz and cocktails. The girls I knew had sad and sullen gray faces, distant gay traces that used to be there. You could see where they'd been washed away by too many through the day. 12 o'clock tales. Then you came along with your siren song to tempt me to madness. I thought for a while that your poignant smile was tinged with the sadness of a great love for me. Again, I was wrong. Life is lonely again, and only last year everything seemed so sure. Again, a trough full of heart will only be a bore. A week in Paris will ease the bite of it. To smile in spite of it, I'll forget you. I will, while yet you are still burning inside my brain. Romance is mush, stifling those who strive. I'll live a lush life in some small dive, and there I'll be while I rot with the rest. Thank you.
The fact that sort of stuns people the first time they learn it about that song is that he was 18 years old when he wrote it.
Incredible. Yeah, he used to play it at parties and things before it had ever been, before he had met Duke Ellington, let alone worked with him, and before anybody knew who Billy Strayhorn was.
You know, yeah, so. That's not quite Mozartian, but it's pretty stunning nonetheless.
Yeah. It's up there.
What was he reading? What was he drinking?
I wonder, yeah.
Yeah, you know. Speaking of which, your background, I mean, in terms of family, musical at all?
Yeah, yeah. I guess I'm the only professional musician, if you can call it that. but pretty much everybody. I've got a younger brother, Tom, and older sister, Carrie, and they both play. Carrie, my sister, is an excellent classical pianist, although she doesn't do it professionally. She's a teacher. She's a college professor, but she plays piano very, very well. And my younger brother, Tom, plays just about everything, guitar mostly these days, but studied clarinet. And
I hate people like that.
It's
disgusting.
And my dad, Mike, is has always been an avid jazz fan and a big jazz record collector, his collection being somewhat diminished by my numerous thefts, but he also played drums, not professionally, but he was a jazz drummer for a time. I think he might have, who knows, he might have pursued it, I wouldn't wish that on him, but.
drumming or a jazz career?
And my mom, Willie, plays... well, drumming would be great, a jazz career, I don't know.
Yeah.
My mom, Willie, plays piano. But taking piano lessons when you're a kid, you know, I guess fewer people now have that experience. But I had examples, you know, not just amongst teachers and other players, but in my home. I mean, the very piano that I was playing on, my mom and my sister could sit down and play much better than I could. So that's a really strong incentive to sort of figure something out.
Yeah, well, you know, they say that you model the behavior that kids pick up, and so having people around that you can model that behavior on is amazing.
Yeah,
invaluable. How young were you when you first lessons?
I'm told I was... lessons 7. I'm told I was 4 when I started playing.
I was getting lessons at 4.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh, jeez. Oh, God. Wow. Well, you know, there was my dad had trained to be an operatic singer in Vienna before he had to skedaddle the scene.
Right.
So, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Didn't take.
Well, you piano lessons or sing lessons or both?
Piano lessons. Okay. Piano lessons. Now.
Wow. At 4 years old. I mean, that doesn't go away. If it gets ingrained that early, that's...
The rage doesn't go away. Speaking of which, when you write these dark songs and you seem like such a sunny fellow, what's the deal?
I am sunny. I'm someone who wakes up in the morning feeling good. I've been very, very fortunate in my life, and I've had a lot of people who have been very kind to me, so I have reason to have a sunny disposition. Got my health, as far as I know.
Mm-hmm.
Had a really good breakfast, and so on and so forth. But I think it is something like, I don't know, somewhere between catharsis and exorcism. I think that a situation that I'm upset about or an observation that I can't reconcile myself with is useful to me because I can make a nice song out of it, and that's constructive.
And then it's out of your system?
It is, and it also, I mean, there's nothing, you know, misery loves company, so there's nothing, if you're feeling bad, there's nothing like a miserable song to make you feel better. I mean, I don't think I'm the only one who feels that way. You want to know that someone out there agrees with you,
yeah.
You know, and understands what you're going through, so...
Hence the blues.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Apropos of dark and depressing songs, brilliant dark and depressing songs, I highly recommend You Don't Really Want to Know off of which record? Is that on Southbound or is
man.
It?
Is that on... No, that's on... I want to say that's on the New Memphis Underground.
New Memphis Underground.
Is that on...
Yeah, I think it's New Memphis Underground.
I should probably know that.
By Charlie Wood. Amazing song. Conducive to the feeling that I get more and more these days that the species is failing its audition. But in any case, in the meantime... Charlie Wood, Thank you for coming to the studio where you and Danny Thompson came and recorded, the very studio where where we recorded a song for my new record, which was a thrill, believe me. And
for me as well.
Thank you. Playing with Danny, I bet.
Yeah, very much so.
Amazing, amazing.
He's a legend.
Yeah, and deservedly so. And would you play us out with something sort of up-tempo of yours?
Well, let's see. I got a bouncy one about songs and songwriting and how there aren't any good songs anymore.
There you go.
It's called A Song. Whatever happened to the song? A pretty melody, so happy songs can hum along. A sad and simple story of a love gone wrong. Whatever happened to the song? Whatever happened to the time? It seems like yesterday when working wasn't worth a dime. 'Cause love was all we needed and it was sublime. Whatever happened to the time? Before everyone got indoctrinated, before everything had been bought and sold, remember how music intoxicated, how it got in your heart and your head and took hold. Now music is music incorporated, and each demographic must do as it's told. New listeners all get inoculated. If it seems to lack substance, your soul is too old. Whatever happened to the world? Another kind heart breaks as each new battle flag's unfurled. So victory to the meanest or most cunning or headstrong. Figures we got shown the door, we never quite belong. But I hope someone will tell them after we are all long gone. There used to be a thing we called a song.
And finally, ladies and gentlemen, this week, the United Nations has called for an immediate suspension of government-mandated U.S. ethanol production because ethanol is made from corn, and the drought is making corn prices go up. And the U.N. is concerned that that's going to make food prices go up, and nobody mentions that you could feed cattle something other than corn. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the grass. That concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same airwaves, however you may be listening. Thanks to the gang at Air Edel Studios in London, especially Nick Taylor, the engineer. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless and the home of the Rubber Promise. So long from London.